Are you recording? Okay, we're back with cause number 18434, Wichita County, and Environmental Engineering Geotechnics, is that it? Something like that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Am I relatively close?
Yes.
EENG, can we say that?
EEG?
Yes, we're going to be calling it EENG.
EENG, perfect, thank you.
May it please the court, my name's Ernest Wittring. I represent Wichita County, and Wichita County requests that this court reverse the award of over $11,000 in cost issued against it. This case involves probably one rule of civil procedure, 205.3F, the awarding of costs for third-party discovery. So in contrast to the previous cases, this is relatively straightforward. Wichita County requests that this case be remanded to permit it to conduct limited discovery regarding EEG's original or its claim for third-party costs. Briefly stated, the procedural posture was as follows. Wichita County initiated a claim against a defendant under the Texas Water Code, which is not at issue. It sought discovery from EEG and received a one-page invoice for over $14,000 in costs. That resulted in a motion for cost with a hearing. We attended the hearing. At that time, the trial court wanted to know if Wichita County wanted to proceed. Wichita County, I objected to proceeding if there was going to be additional evidence introduced and asked for limited discovery. The court denied the request, started the hearing, and awarded $11,000 in costs. So Wichita County is requesting that this court address the issue of whether discovery is appropriate in 205.3F proceeding. It is Wichita County's position that discovery should be permitted. Discovery should be tailored to their request and to the situation, as all discovery usually is, by the trial court. That in this case, it was not permitted to conduct that discovery, and as a result, was put to a hearing in which it was being asked to, at that time, pay over $14,000 in costs. Admittedly, there are other matters that have higher amounts in controversy, but there are other matters that have a lot less in controversy, and discovery is permitted. What we requested from the trial court was a limited corporate representative deposition to explore the basis of the costs, and we were denied that opportunity.
Did you need to go to the court on that? I mean, could you have just asked EENG to do discovery?
We could have requested from
EENG. And did you have to? Did you have to start with them?
I don't think we had to start with EENG, and here's the timing on it. The motion for costs was set for hearing on May 31st with a June 10th hearing date, 11th hearing date, in Travis County. So at that point in time, there wouldn't have been time to file a motion for continuance or to seek discovery before having to show up for the hearing in which the evidence was going to be introduced. So the position that I took at the hearing was, if the court's ready to go forward on their single page that they attached to their motion for costs, I'm prepared to go forward. If the court is now going to permit them to put on evidence and I'm going to see documents for the first time at this hearing, I'd like an opportunity to conduct discovery, and that was the request that was denied.
Can I ask you a question? Is that the only issue that y'all are bringing before us, or do y'all have a sufficiency issue as well?
We do have a sufficiency issue, and we've detailed the reasons why we think the award is not based on sufficient evidence. It's an abuse of discretion standard of review from our review of the applicable authorities. So the trial court has an abuse of discretion standard of review on what they award in terms of costs. The reason we think that that was violated is because they, for very specific reasons, there was an award of time for EEG's alleged time they spent gathering documents from May 7th on through May 23rd, when in fact they sent their last documents to the Copy Center Office Max on May 7th. We think that there was no basis for awarding times any time during that period of time from the 7th through the 23rd because the copying had already been sent off for the copying. Similarly, they did not get the subpoena from April 20th to April 25th, and yet their time records that they submitted for reimbursement included time during those 5 days. The record is unclear about why they think they're entitled to recover costs for responding to a subpoena they didn't get for 5 days. I think this court can review the brief record. The reason they did that is because they got a call from their client of theirs saying, oh, we need to start gathering documents, and they started doing that to assist their client in preparing to defend against Wichita County's case. That's not a cost that Wichita County should incur. So we do have those efficiencies.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Absolutely.
Do you consider that a challenge to factual or legal sufficiency or both?
Those specifics are challenges to the legal sufficiency. There's just no evidence about why they should get costs from April 20th to the 25th or past May 7th.
Do we have any way to parse those out? Does this court have any way to parse those out, assuming?
On this factual record, yes. There's no evidence about why they incurred costs from the 20th to the 25th. I think it's undisputed in the record that they did not get the subpoena until the 25th. I think it's also undisputed in the record the last time they submitted documents for scanning or copying was May
7th. What about after the 25th?
After the 5th, the 25th, from the 25th to the 7th, there is in the record evidence that they incurred some costs.
Okay. Now, and how do we parse those out? Which is kind of going back to the legal versus factual sufficiency.
Well, in this record, they were unable to distinguish the amount of time spent between the 25th and the 7th, the time in which they had the subpoena before they sent off their records. Of course, because we were prevented from taking a deposition, I was unable to explore that further. On cross, on the fly, at the hearing, the witness said they didn't keep good daily records of things. He thought most of their time was spent before the 7th, but he was
You say able. You were prevented from taking a deposition?
That's correct. The hearing started before we were able to take the deposition.
Okay, so let's go back to your first issue, which is the
preservation.
Yes. How did you preserve, in the record, can you show us where you objected to going forward with the hearing? I believe that the trial court had given you an option if you want a continuance because of the local rules in Travis County and the setting, without consultation, I'll give you a consultation. Where in the record did you ask for a continuance, and does that preserve your issue?
Certainly. That whole discussion is on page 7 to 10 of the record, and that exchange was the court asking me if I wanted to go forward, and I said I'd not want to go forward if this court is going to permit them to call evidence. At that point, the court made a statement that he didn't think it was an evidentiary hearing, and then there was discussion with opposing counsel, and then the court said, the record, I think, reflects the court looking down, saying, I'm looking at something, and saying, no, we're going to go forward with the hearing at that point in time. I think.
And at that point, did you object?
I did not renew my objection to going forward at the hearing.
At that time, you did not have, you had not asked EE&G to do any discovery on this issue.
We had put in our response to the motion for costs that if the court was going to permit them to introduce evidence in addition to the one page, that we wanted to take a limited corporate representative deposition notice. That's in footnote 4 on page 4 of that response. And that's how the record stands. So it's page 7 to 10. The court asking me if we wanted to go forward, and I said we do not want to go forward if the court is going to permit them to put on additional evidence. The court, I think two pages later, said we're going to go ahead and have this hearing, and that's the way the record stands on the appeal. And I think that is sufficient error preservation under Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 33.1. Objected on the record to going forward without the opportunity to do discovery, and the court, I think, explicitly and implicitly denied my objection, preserving error. That raises something else that, of course, harmful error. What would you have done if you've gotten a deposition? Well, I would have been able to explore the basis of, what happened before the 20th and the 25th, what happened after the 7th and the 25th. Do you have any additional records? And would have been able to do, what I envisioned was taking no more than 2 hours of a corporate representative deposition to explore the basis of a claim of $14,000 against my client. I've identified for the court the Ford v. Castillo case, which is a 279 Southwest 3rd 656. That is not in the briefing, but it discusses.
Could you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Sure. Ford v. Castillo. Mm-hmm. It's a 279 Southwest 3rd 656. And that discusses, in these cases, in the cases that I cite in my brief, that there's no cases directly on point dealing with Rule 205.3F. They deal with discovery broadly for claims in the traditional plaintiff versus the defendant. I think those principles apply to this dispute and should apply. But in the Ford case, it talks about what the harmful error if you're not able to develop a record on what you would have gotten in discovery. Specifically, the court says that when discovery is denied, and because of the denial, the evidence sought does not appear in the record, determining harm from the denial is impossible, and the party is prevented from properly presenting its case on appeal. And then the court goes on to say that's harmful error. There's another case, which is Tom Scott, Inc. versus McElhaney, 798 Southwest 2nd, 556, another Texas Supreme Court case in 1984. So we would also rely upon that. So in terms of how we were harmed, I think there are certainly enough questions on this record that warranted discovery, that we would have been able to develop evidence to respond to this claim for $14,000. And the fact that we weren't able to do that discovery, it presumes harmful error, or in this context, I think presumes harmful error based upon the Ford Motor versus Castillo case and the McElhaney case. Those two cases establish harmful error and require remanding of this case for further proceedings on discovery.
So you talk about harmful error, you talk about sufficiency. I'm curious what relief you're asking for. Because I was less than clear from that from reading your brief.
Well, then that's a deficiency in the brief, and I'll cure it now. We're asking for a remand to the trial court so that we can have limited discovery. Which in this context, I would imagine.
Is that a legal sufficiency?
Well, let me ask a question. So that's for issue number one. If
yes.
We disagree with you on issue number one, and so we're just looking at the sufficiency issue.
Correct.
Which you've said is legal sufficiency, then what is it that you're asking
right.
us to do?
Vacate the award. They have not presented sufficient evidence.
Render or remand?
You know, if they have not presented sufficient evidence, legally sufficient evidence to support their award, then it's a render.
That's correct. I think if it's a legal sufficiency, it's a render. I think if it's a factual sufficiency, then we'd be able to remand.
And how would we do that considering there's...
Well,
in order to get to your sufficiency question, we have to go, well, it was outside the 20th and not until the 25th, but then through the 7th, and then there's the costs and things like that. Is that legal or is that
factual?
Yeah, I mean,
you know, in this context, it would be a legal argument. They have not presented and met their burden to establish sufficient evidence to support an award of, you know, $11,283.
So it's all or nothing?
On that point of error, yeah, it's all or nothing. In terms of the first point, the first point is we think that in these proceedings, because this, you know, in an age of electronic discovery, in an age of, you know, ever more data and ever more sophisticated means of preserving that data, the amount of controversy in this case, which is substantial, is 13,916 or almost 14,000 originally. That's going to be multiplied in cases involving e-discovery, and that places third parties in the enviable position of being able to send an invoice over saying you're going to pay this invoice. If this court rules that no discovery is permissible, then they're going to be able to schedule a hearing without producing any advance notice of their witnesses, and we're off to the races, and the potential party seeking the discovery is going to then be faced with, you know, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars of costs. It's not unusual in an e-discovery case to be facing that kind of cost and exposure for producing e-discovery or requesting it from a third party.
Well, so if we do the legal sufficiency, do we even have to get to issue number one?
The court does not. If they have not met their burden to provide sufficient evidence to support the trial court's ruling, then no. The court does not have to get to the first issue. The court can skip that issue altogether and provide, you know, the parties in Texas with guidance on how to proceed with regard to third-party discovery.
What is our standard of review on your second issue?
It's an abuse of discretion.
I guess where I'm having trouble is under your argument of legal sufficiency, all or nothing, you know, abuse of discretion. I mean, I understand the argument well. The fact that it has dates that could not have been responsive to the subpoena in and of itself makes that invoice maybe questionable. But under abuse of discretion, we have to find that what the judge did was not reasonable under any circumstance. I mean, that's a pretty high burden.
It is a high burden. I mean, you know, the abuse of discretion, and we're, the court is presented with a case which there's, we've not found any other case of directly addressing this particular rule of civil procedure. We agree that for this context, it's an abuse of discretion, but if they have not met their legal burden to produce evidence, you know, it's similar to an attorney's fees case in which they don't segregate their fees. They have not legally presented evidence to support their award of attorney's fees. But I agree, it's the abuse of discretion is more lenient to the trial court, and we're not suggesting that that change. What we are suggesting is that we be able to conduct discovery to be able to respond to the allegations. And I think the request for discovery is all the more important if the trial court is going to get an abuse of discretion standard of review, because it's much more difficult to challenge on appeal under that standard than it would be under, you know, preponderance of the evidence. And with that, I'll sit down and respond and rebut.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Donald Grissom on behalf of EE&G. Obviously, I'm here to say that the court did not abuse its discretion, and you should uphold the award of a little over $11,000 in cost. And the reason for that is this, that when Wichita County filed this lawsuit in early 2018, one of the first things they did was subpoena the records of EE&G. They conducted virtually no other discovery. They targeted EE&G, and why did they do that? Because what they were suing over was a case, an old underground storage pollution case that had been sitting for 20 plus years that they decided to act on under a particular provision of the water code. It just so happened that EE&G was one of the contractors who had worked on that remediation site, environmental site, for the longest period of time, 19 years, going back to 1997. They did so under the direction of the state of Texas. All of their activities were directed by the state of Texas and paid for by the state of Texas through what is now the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality, who was just here. So they got the subpoena, which was vast, asking for all of their records, all their work, all their communications, going back to when whatever their records go. Just so happened that EE&G had in fact maintained all of their records going back 19 years. And so it was an exhaustive search, as we laid out, an exhaustive search to collect those records and get those in a format that could be produced. And going back to 1997, not all of it was electronic. Many of it, at that time, most of the agencies did everything by fax, not email.
You seem to be addressing the sufficiency question.
I am first, just as a background. I think that
is there anywhere in the record that supports a trial court's ruling on the request to take discovery of EE&G?
No, I don't think they ever. I don't think that they ever asked for discovery on EE&G in a format that the trial court could rule upon. They never sent a notice of deposition. They never made a specific request to the trial court. We want to continue so we can take their deposition on these limited issues. None of that exists. So
is this question preserved for this court?
I believe it is not. Because no, that request was never made. Going to the sufficiency, back to the sufficiency issue, he said if he could have...
Well, let me ask it another way, just to make sure that I've covered all my bases on all the potential, well, not all of them, but most of the questions that I might have on this question. Is the trial court's saying we're going to go ahead with this hearing here, is that an implicit
denial?
No, I don't think it is. I think the court gave him opportunity to say, I want a continuance of this setting for this purpose. That did not occur. And I don't think the rule provides for that.
So that's not what's going to, when we go back and look at the record, that's not going to be on page 4 of the record?
He does not say, I want a continuance.
Okay.
He just says, are you ready to proceed? And I think he said, I don't know that I'm ready to proceed if they are going to do X.
Okay.
I don't know that, I don't think you can, I don't think that is a denial or an implicit denial of a motion for continuance, because the motion for continuance was never made.
And how long, do you recall how long of the span was in between this billing and the hearing that we're talking about? I mean, was there time to seek discovery on this limited issue? Do you know? And I get that that's probably not.
I'm
just curious.
The records were produced on May the 29th, 28th or 29th. It's when they were actually produced. We had they'd gotten a subpoena on the 25th. We'd asked for 2 or 3 days extra because we were getting them in. So I think they were actually produced on the 29th along with
The invoice?
Sent along with the invoice. We have this invoice for the cost of production. The email back was, under what authority do we have to pay you cost? We told them under 205.3, you have to pay cost. And then we had dead silence after that. Nothing. So we filed our motion for cost. There was no communication after that as to, well, we'd like to reset this, or we'd like to take his deposition, or how do you come up with this? None
Remind
of that.
Remind me, when did y'all set?
We
when
filed.
Did y'all give him the notice?
We filed them. We filed the motion on May the 30th, and they either got notice that afternoon or the morning of the 31st. Either one, but it was very quickly there that we filed it and got the setting.
And I think the hearing was on
June the 11th. So it was 12 days after filing was the motion. During that interim period of time, there was no request for deposition discovery. I don't think they're entitled to it. I think that's a matter for the court to determine on cost. I have never been in a proceeding and on where, especially with the banks and the financial code, we're asking for records. There is no, we don't get to depose the corporate, you know, the president of the bank to find out why did your people spend this much time retrieving records, or why did your lawyer spend 5 hours talking to you about it. We don't get that privilege. It's for the court to determine under these circumstances that's unreasonable. And here the court found that the cost of $11,000 was reasonable. What he had posed to the court that if I'd had an opportunity to depose, here's what I would have asked, is how much time did you spend before April 25th? It's in the record. Mr. Owens testified a half hour. I just wanted to know if we had records going back all the way. So between April 20th and April 25th, he testified under cross-examination a half hour.
But didn't he have problems? I mean, he couldn't testify as to at least Mr.
Britton?
Yes. He couldn't testify as to when he had started doing work. And if he had done any work prior to
April
25th.
He did not testify as to whether or not Mr. Britton had done any work, in his testimony, whether Mr. Britton had done any work prior to that time. As far as the work after, and I think this is an arbitrary position to take, is that you can only get costs from the time once you deliver them to a copy service, your time is over with. That's an arbitrary and ludicrous position.
Well, I was actually talking about prior to the subpoena being
right.
I mean, I do think the rule says you can get it, you know, in response to a subpoena. I don't think it allows you to get it for work prior to the subpoena, even if you're being uber careful and kind of wanting to hit the ground running, because we don't know if you're going to get a subpoena or not. So my question is as to, I believe that Mr. Owen testified that as to the female, the other, and I apologize for not remembering.
Mr. Britton and then Ms. Millett.
As to Ms. Millett, that she had not started work until after the 25th.
Correct.
But as to Mr. Britton, he didn't know. So under the sufficiency argument, how do we find that there's any evidence to show us that part of Mr. Britton's charges were not prior to the subpoena being served?
There's nothing in the record that tells us one way or the other. And that's the only way I know to answer that. There's nothing in the record that tells us, other than Mr. Owen's testimony, he was the one in charge of this. And he's the only one up until they got, I think by implication, we're talking about implication, take an implication from his testimony, that he, up until we got the subpoena, there was nothing, the communication was directed to him, do we have records on this? He spent about a half hour saying, yes, we do. And I think implication, his testimony leads you to the point that nothing further happened until there actually was a subpoena and act to do something. Otherwise, there was nothing for Mr. Britton to do, because Mr. Owens is the only one who had the, as he testified, he's the only one who had the length of time there that went back to the very beginning. As you remember, Mr. Britton didn't even start, according to the testimony,
until
2007. So 10 years later. So there was nothing for Mr. Britton to do for those prior periods, because they knew they would have had anything between 2007 further.
So do you agree with Mr. Warden's interpretation that it's an all or nothing, that and that's where I think Justice Goodwin is going. Can you parse it out? Can you say, well, okay, you've got the, you know, Office Depot invoices that are there and introduced, and we have testimony to that that shows to that, and you know, was that arbitrary and capricious? But then maybe, you know, whether it's Mr. Britton or something else that was on there on the invoice, obviously the legal fees are not included,
right,
and those need to be taken out, which the trial court did. So do you agree that it's an all or nothing kind of thing, that on the sufficiency issue, if we find that there is some sufficiency, then it's all, and if we find that there's not sufficiency, your client gets nothing?
I'm torn on that.
I know, right? What are you going to argue?
I believe that far as you could, if the court were to go to that direction, which I don't think there's a basis for doing it, but if it did, then if it could render on the basis that there is testimony that a half hour of Mr. Owen's time, calculated $185 an hour, could be deducted from that as being pre. I think there's no basis for taking anything else off of pre. Now to his argument that, well, what about after? Mr. Owen's testimony was, yes, I spent a couple hours when I got these documents back to go through them to make sure, yes, this is everything we've sent and this is all that we've got. So I think that is certainly justifiable up until the point they are turned over and actually produced, whatever, until they're actually produced, whatever time is spent there is legitimate until they're actually produced. And that's, I think he's accounted for all of that time. And with that, unless there are other questions, and I'll just tell you, when I was a much younger lawyer than I am now, and my first opportunity to ever appear before appellate court happened to be the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, and it was on abuse of discretion case, and I was the appellant, and the first words out of the judge's mouth was, "Counselor, do you understand what a burden you have?" I thought I did. Apparently I was wrong. But The second thing I learned was from the esteemed counsel, who was a Texaco lawyer, who got up, and his argument was, and I'll never forget it, was my father was an esteemed jurist. And he said, son, when you're right on the facts and right on the law, sit down and be quiet. So with that, I'll sit down.
Thank you.
Having had a chance to look back at the record, there's a discussion on page 7 of the reporter's record, which I say if I'm about to hear testimony from a new witness, I'm going to request an opportunity to depose the witness. It's not clear at that point in time that the court was going to grant them the ability to put on evidence. Later on that same page at the bottom, lines 24 and 25, that being the fact, I would like to, I'm quoting myself, that being the fact, I would like an opportunity, if they're about to give testimony on the stand, to take a deposition to figure out the basis for, you know, 38 hours to produce documents for what their claim is, $2,000 worth of attorney's fees. The court then responds on page 8, line 7. I don't know that a motion for cost is an evidentiary hearing. I'm just asking if you want to proceed. And at that point, here's the quote, line 11, I'm not ready to continue to handle this hearing if they're going to put evidence on the stand. Court then asks Mr. Grissom if they are. He says that they are, and the court says, give me a second here. We're going to proceed. And that's the state on the record, in addition to the response asking if they're going to introduce additional testimony, because at that point in time, the record was their one-page invoice. On page 4 of the response, that's footnote 4, I asked for a corporate representative deposition as well. And I don't know if it goes to the merits of this court's, but we didn't just start with EEG to get records. I think in our response, we outlined the fact that we went to the TCEQ to get records. We then went to Southwest Convenience Stores, who told us all the records for this will be at EEG's offices. They're our environmental consultant. That's where you need to go for the records. And so that's why they got the subpoena for the records, and that's why we're in this dispute here today. The discussion on the record, not to burden the court with infinite record sites, but on page 55 of the same hearing, I asked if they entered daily time records, and they said they did not. It's not a normal business project for us. He didn't have what we have on what time they spent is that one page and really the three lines in the record in which they put down hours and a rate, and that's it. That's what we have in the record. This is an important issue, not just for us, of course, but for all litigants. In most cases, we have to address, you know, subpoenas to third parties, what we're going to be asked to pay for those, and how we're going to be able to respond to, you know, an invoice that you get out of the blue for $14,000 that includes $2,000 in attorney's fees costs that they're not entitled to, that includes hundreds of dollars of copying costs for hard copies that were not produced.
And is there anything in the record, and I hate to keep asking you this,
because
I know I can read it, and I will, the parts that I haven't, where you raise the question of the reasonableness of the rate, or where you talk about the 25-cent scanning versus I would have preferred paper document? I mean...
Yes, I'm sorry. All that is, of course, the answer to the court is yes, that's in the record. I believe we have cited those record sites in our brief. Of course, we're finding out a lot of this as the hearing is going on, which is another reason that, another reason the discovery is appropriate, because having to analyze this on the fly is, you know, fairly difficult as you're hearing about the evidence for the first time. But yes, the argument about scanning versus copying was made on the record. Argument about why 270...
But in your request, did you say, well,
there was, if the court is asking between May 11th, which I believe was the Thursday, and I don't remember whether I got it candidly on the Thursday or the Friday morning, but between the Friday and the Monday hearing, the record does reflect that I explained to the court why my response was late, because we had other obligations and council had not conferred with us about it. I'm not picking a fight about that, right. But that is an explanation for why we didn't put together a motion for continuance, why we didn't put together a motion for discovery, why we didn't do all of those things. And, of course, showing up at the hearing, not really knowing, are they going to call a witness? Aren't they going to call a witness? We proceeded, or I proceeded, as I thought reasonable, and made the record that the court has in front of it. We want to prevail on this case. I think it's also important that if the court could provide guidance to litigants on how a request for costs should operate, it would be useful. If parties are entitled to conduct discovery, I think discovery fosters more resolution of these types of claims, minimizes the number of controversies the trial court might have to preside over in the future. And with that, I'll close. Thank you.
Thank you. Case will be submitted. And with that, we are adjourned for the day.